Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, telling the story of what it means to be young and female and Muslim in America. NPR's Leila Fadel has been doing this terrific series about the next generation of Muslim women. And when we heard the inaugural story, we knew this is a discussion that we should bring to you. Here's Leila on Morning Edition introducing the series.
A new school is always hard, but doing it as a Muslim kid of color wearing a religious head covering is even harder.
And like, it's kind of just weird because they just kind of see you as the outsider and they leave you like that.
You'll hear another story from Leila's series, Muslims in America, A New Generation, near the end of the hour. But we've asked two young women to carry the discussion further with us. What's it like to explore different identities as a Muslim woman? How do those identities meet the expectations of people in the communities around them? And as we hear the personal experiences of our guests, I'd like to hear from you, too. What's often misunderstood about being a Muslim woman in America from within the Muslim community and from the outside as well? And for all of us, how much room do you think there is for this next generation of Muslims to create a story and an identity that doesn't necessarily conform to expectations? So I want to hear from you. If you're a Muslim woman, you're living in our region, in the Twin Cities or beyond, how it feels, what's most often misunderstood, and how you manage expectations from within the community and from that. And then from the rest of us, what do you think is most often misunderstood about contemporary Muslims in America, especially women? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Blair Imani is with us. She's an activist and executive director of Equality for Her, and she's with us today from New York. And Blair, welcome to the show. It's good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate what NPR is doing to tell our stories.
I do, too. Ikhlas Salim is with us. She's an Atlanta-based writer and digital media strategist. She's co-host of this terrific podcast I've been listening to called Identity Politics. And Ikhlas, welcome. It's really good to hear you on the show. By the way, I listened to your discussion yesterday about representation. So fair warning, we're going to talk about that today. All right?
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you for having me on the show.
You know, Blair, I'm hoping that we're gonna dig into the dual tensions of expectations from within the Muslim community and the pressure that comes from outside, which I guess says, look, I have a narrow view of what it means to be Muslim and you don't look or act like that. Do you experience that?
I definitely do. It's interesting for me because I grew up Christian, so I saw what it was like to, you know, be outside of the community and have those misunderstandings and those misconceptions of Muslim womanhood, and then to step into that and then defy those expectations myself has been a really interesting experience.
So you've intrigued me here with there were expectations around being a Christian that, what, don't feel all that different from having come into the Muslim faith and then confronted those expectations too? How are they the same or different?
Well, I think, well, a great example is from Amani Al-Khattabi when she was creating Muslim Women's Day last year. This year we had the second one, but she was confronted by all of these editors who wanted to create this ridiculous, you know, medley of what does it mean for Muslim women to do makeup? And she was like, would you be asking the same of Christian women? And they were like, no, Christian women are so diverse. And she was like, exactly. Muslim women are also very diverse. And so I think because Muslim women and, you know, just Islam is not portrayed as central to the American identity the way Christianity is, we view it as foreign and then view it as a monolith because that's how the human mind works.
Ikhlas, this gets us right to the representation conversation that I said I was listening to yesterday on your
yes.
podcast. You were talking about how
there's this perception that there is something monolithic about what it means to be a contemporary Muslim woman in America. And even if the sense is that some younger Muslim women are pushing the envelope on that identity, then everybody has to look like that or be like that. Tell me a little bit about, tell me about how you came into that conversation with your co-host.
Yes, definitely. The conversation came about, too. We were at Columbia in February, Columbia University, for a Muslim Protagonist Conference. And we were in a workshop about YouTube bloggers who focus on fashion and makeup. And this one Muslim woman stood up and she was like, what if I don't want to put on makeup every day? What if I don't want to wear the latest trends? Then what does that make me? Does that make me backwards? Right. And so we're in this amazing time where you do have Muslim women pushing the envelope, going further, challenging what it means to be particularly a Muslim woman in this country. But then you also have to make sure that you're not creating that divide so wide where now that represents what it means to be a Muslim woman, right? Because we still have a lot of Muslim women who are like, you know what? I just want to wear my plain black hijab, go to work, and go home. And that also represents what it means to be a Muslim woman in this country. So I think right now, something that we're trying to grapple with is creating that balance, right, where you don't have to be this one type of thing that means you stand for this. And I think, right, that is representative in all types of faith traditions and cultures that there is room for everyone.
Right. You know, I have to say, Iklas, I got a kick out of you and Mecca talking about the hijabi blogger and how and how they kind of set the tone for what it means to be a contemporary Muslim woman today. And how some women are very comfortable going along with that, but others aren't.
Yes,
it's a lot
yes.
of pressure for sure. Yeah. Sorry to chime in.
Go ahead, Blair. Go right ahead.
I think, yeah, just speaking from my own perspective, like I have a lot of relatives who are in that blogger space. And so I felt like there was already a lot of pressure. And then I'm hearing from a lot of folks that because my hair isn't shown and because I have less style options, that I have to have a full face of makeup every day to be presentable. And it's like, wow, like you want me to wear a hijab a certain way. You want me to put my makeup on a certain way, but not too much. And like it just speaks to the way society controls women, I think.
Let me grab a call here from Hasina in Minneapolis. Hey, Hasina, I'm so glad you called and heard the show. What are you thinking about?
Well, so one thing that's difficult for me, and I grew up multiracial and multi-religious. My father is Muslim, so I have been raised Muslim. Is this comment from Muslims and non-Muslims alike, is that I'm not Muslim enough because I don't follow all of the rules and all of the dogma. I don't cover my hair. I do some things and not others. And then my comment back to people is, show me a Christian who follows every single Christian rule, right? That's difficult for me, especially when some especially older Muslims sort of criticize younger Muslim women for not following every single rule, saying, well, you're not really a Muslim or you know, you're not devout enough.
This is really great, Hasina, because this gets to what I wanted to talk about, which is the tension that comes from within the Muslim community and from without. And Blair, I mean, she's saying, you know, there's kind of this set of expectations. This is the way you show your devotion. And if you're not doing that, then you're not reaching that standard that we've set.
Right.
Yeah, it's definitely. Sorry.
Yeah, Hasina, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I find it really difficult to navigate even within my own family, trying to prove that I'm Muslim enough.
Yeah.
But retain my American individuality. And as people were saying previously, I don't see a lot of Christians having to explain how Christian they are within the context
so
of
true.
Being American, right?
Yes,
Blair, go right
sure.
ahead. Hasina, thanks. Excellent.
I think it's interesting, too, because, you know, I'm here in New York and there's a lot of different faiths in the mix. And I always hear from my Jewish friends that they're Jewish. And that's like the fun joke. We don't really have, I think, an equivalent in Islam. And then because I'm a convert, I'm a convert, I'm bisexual, I'm black, and the anti-blackness, the bias against converts, and the homophobia that exists within and without the community, sometimes well, I feel like it excludes me from the space. But I was reading the Quran recently, and there's this passage, 3:186, and the segment from it was, "And you will hear much that is hurtful from people who were given the book before you. But if you remain steadfast and mindful of Allah, that will surely show your determination." And that was like really the perfect thing I needed to hear and needed to read, because even the Quran says, yeah, there's going to be people who place expectations of you and say hurtful things to you, but remain steadfast to Allah. And I think that's really what Islam is all about, is, you know, navigating the expectations of the world, but knowing your personal relationship with Allah.
You know, I think this is important to draw out, Ikhlas, because as Blair was describing her interpretation of the Quran, I was thinking, for many, many, many years, decades, centuries, there's been a debate about what the Bible is telling Christians. And we're very accepting of the idea that there may be many different interpretations and, right, many different ways to be devoted to your faith. Mm-hmm. Is the Muslim faith open to that yet? This idea that Blair may have an interpretation that doesn't meet with a more traditional interpretation of the Quran.
Yes. I mean, within Islam, there is a whole history of religious scholars, theological scholars, scholars of law who debated for centuries and still continue to debate based upon your interpretation, right? We all read from the points in which we sit. And so Islam allows for this expansiveness of interpretation of Quran, of laws. So that's something that definitely exists within the tradition. I think it's something that often Muslims don't like to admit exists, especially in this country where you're operating under a dominant narrative of what it means to be Muslim. And so, I mean, just like within any tradition, right, there's this claim to hold power to what you deem to be true, and anything that doesn't fall in line with that, right, you want to kind of marginalize that. And so within Islam, there's an expansive tradition and multiple interpretations. But, you know, there are gatekeepers for everything.
That's
right. There are gatekeepers for everything. And so I think when you have people along the margins that push back and say, wait a minute, let's really look back at history. Let's really look back at, you know, what was possible and what wasn't possible. And I think that we can learn a lot from that if we really do dig deep into our tradition.
This is a conversation, if you've just gotten in on it, that was inspired by, I guess, my listening to our team's listening here to Layla Fadel's fantastic series about what it means to be a Muslim woman in contemporary America. And Layla, if you haven't caught the series, it's called Muslims in America, A New Generation. I heard the first one and then went online to check out some of the other episodes. And we just thought, hey, this opens up a discussion that's perfect for this show. Let's talk about what it means to be young and female and Muslim in America and how that meets expectations or new ideas about that are changing those expectations. And we've asked two guests to be with us to talk about this. Blair Imani is with us. She's executive director of Equality for Her. And Ikhlas Salim, she's an Atlanta-based writer and co-host of the podcast. I recommend it, have been listening to it. It's called Identity Politics. And she does that with Mecca Ali. And I'm asking you, as you listen in here, what's often misunderstood about being a Muslim woman in America and maybe in our area from within the Muslim community and from the outside? How much room do you think there is for this next generation of Muslim women to create a story and an identity that may not conform to previous expectations or these narrow ideas of what it means to be Muslim? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR to Brad in Minnetonka. Hey, Brad, thanks so much for waiting. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I just have two comments. I'll make this kind of quick.
Okay.
Your guest said that there's a lot of diversity in the Muslim community here in the U.S., and that, you know, people outside the community don't really understand it. Well, I think that that's pretty obvious, just because when you see somebody or a Muslim woman specifically, she's just completely different. So they really stand out like a sore thumb. So that's one comment.
Okay.
The other thing that I wanted to point out was when your guest was talking about applying makeup or wearing different colored hijabs, that she made a comment about how it just goes to show how our society kind of dictates what women do.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't it really the religion that is dictating what women do? I mean, if you follow the roots back far enough, you'll see that women wear hijabs because men told them to.
Okay. Two good comments. So, Blair, I think...
I wouldn't say good.
I would say... So, Blair, let me say this. Brad was saying... the Muslim women, because of the way they're dressing, stand out. And that's why I think he thinks they get, some of the negative attention from people that don't really understand the traditions.
Well, I think that there's something to be said of a fellow to call in and, chime in on this conversation about women. Very bold. And this is, when talking about what I had actually mentioned on his second point, I'm not speaking necessarily about applying makeup being a way to control women. I'm speaking about the way that society dictates what women do, whether it's, mansplaining a point made on the radio or what the woman wears with their clothes. And I think that saying that Muslim women stick out like a sore thumb just speaks to some of the xenophobia that we have as an American society. Just because we're dressing differently and there's this air of foreignness applied to us, we're not seen as individualistic or as mavericks the way other folks are afforded this, kind of exoticness or air of difference. We're seen as a sore thumb or seen as a nuisance or seen as hyper-visible in a negative way. I disagree with his points, but
yeah,
I also think his points speak to the way Americans view Muslims.
Yes, exactly, which is I just want to say this is why I welcome questions like Brad's. I think there is genuine curiosity behind that question. So, Ikhlas, go ahead. You were going to say.
No, I think it's interesting to point Muslim women out as being the sore thumb in terms of the way you see Muslim women dress. But if you go to a beach and you see someone in a bikini, or if you're just walking down the street and someone is in, shorts that are super short with like a crop top, right? Like the way you view someone standing out as a sore thumb is definitely dependent on the lens in which you're looking at them, because I think that they both equally stand out. Whether you're wearing a lot of clothes or no clothes.
The other thing that Brad was interested in was the decision. And I know there's a lot of discussion about this within among Muslim women about the decision to wear the hijab or not, or the fuller drape of the abaya or not. Ikhlas, he's asking, what are the roots of that? And should we and are we struggling with the way we see a decision to wear the hijab or the abaya?
Yes, for sure. So I will say that I am not an Islamic scholar, so I'm not the best person to explain this, but I will give you where the mandate to wear hijab did not come from men. This is, you can find this in Quran, where God instructs women to use a veil, a hijab. And so a hijab has been interpreted to mean multiple things. Some view that just as simple modesty without wearing hijab, so without wearing a head covering, but just to exhibit modest dress, right? And then other people interpret that to mean, yes, you should be wearing a headscarf, your neck should be covered. Then other people interpret that to only your hands should be exposed. So there are different variations in which women have interpreted what the term hijab means. And some people even go as far as to say that hijab just means simply a covering, like not even talking about the physical body, but referring specifically to the wives of the Prophet, that when people would enter their homes, that the women should be behind a veil. So there are different interpretations that have come out of that hijab, which is why you'll see that some women wear it, some women don't. Some women choose to dress modestly without the headscarf. And I'll also say that the restrictions on dress is not just for women. So if you meet men who also express modesty, some of those men, they won't wear short shorts. Their shorts will be to their knees. A lot of them also cover their hair. So you'll see them either wearing turbans or kind of like yarmulkes, like Jewish men wear. You'll see a lot of Muslim men wear that as well. So I just want to be clear that modesty is definitely within Islam, not only restricted to women, but there are rules for men as well.
Ikhlas, I just want to say this, that I know that on the podcast you say we don't do Islam 101, and that's not what this show is either. I don't want to put you in that position.
No, that's fine.
Okay. But I do want to take genuine questions.
Yes.
Blair, did you want to chime in there? Go ahead.
Yeah, coming from a historical perspective, that was actually the way I came into Islam, was doing Islamic study and doing the study of Christianity as well. Mm-hmm. And during the, you know, times of Justinian and, you know, even going past that to, you know, Roman and Greco times, seeing women cover their hair as a sign of status, as a sign of wealth, was very popular as well. But I think, you know, it's the frustrating thing for me is that there is the reality of women being policed, whether that's women being told what to wear, what not to wear, women being told they can't have access to reproductive health. There's a ban now in Iowa on any pregnancy that has a heartbeat being denied an abortion, being denied birth control. And then you have in France the reverse of, I guess, what the American or what the extreme would be, which is denying women the right to cover at the beach. So there are all types of ways that women are policed, and it's not exclusive to Islam, and it's not exclusive to, you know, Saudi Arabia. It's not exclusive to the Middle East. It's happening right here. It's happening in Iowa right now.
Danielle says on Twitter, we have an amazing local organization in Minnesota called Rise Sisterhood, helping Muslim women to connect, build sisterhood, and be empowered. Hey, I'd like to hear from you. If you're a member of Rise Sisterhood, give us a call, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieNPR to Becca in Minneapolis. Becca, thanks for waiting. Tell me what you're thinking as this discussion continues.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call, and thank you for having this discussion. So my comment was just that one misconception that I see a lot, and I can feel it too, is that because Muslim women choose to cover, it's kind of their way of refusing to assimilate, right? So America is supposed to be this great melting pot, and everybody's supposed to just kind of melt in, you know, with what, quote-unquote, an American is. But when a Muslim woman is covered, it's kind of her refusing to do that. And I want people to know that that's not completely true. It's because, you know, the way that we dress is part of our requirements for our religion. And we are really just practicing what this great country is based on, which is freedom of religion, you know.
Amen.
The freedom to be, you know, to practice any religion that you want. So that was just my comment.
Becca, this is excellent, because I think you've named this idea that if you're outwardly showing tradition that feels, again, foreign, I think Ikhlas used that word. I think it's a good one for some of the misconceptions here. It indicates some kind of resistance, right, to wanting to be an American. And you've said it well, that this is the idea that you can show your tradition and be an American and create an identity that mixes in all of that. I mean, Blair, I think where maybe the misunderstanding that I'm trying to get at here is you don't want to accept our traditions of what it means to American as if there's some kind of standard. And that's a rejection of what America is supposed to be about.
I think it's very complex. I've said in the past when asked, oh, but we're all American, aren't we, that I'm black first. And I say that not to be divisive, though to potentially be controversial, but, you know, meaning it very authentically, that as a black American, you're viewed as a substandard citizen. As a Muslim, you're viewed as a second class citizen. And that has been the case historically. You know, only white landowning men could vote. And then that was extended to white women. Then the vote was extended to black people. And then that was denied based on, you know, the segregation and Jim Crow of the day. And that's still happening now with,
You have, you know, the school to prison pipeline, you have mass incarceration, you have voter suppression. So I think that what Americanness means and the aspiration to assimilate is something that we should really investigate as a people, because how can we assimilate if we're not even afforded the basic human rights that our fellow Americans are? And I'm speaking as somebody who's whose family came on slave ships and whose family, you know, comes from that legacy of enslavement. And I think that as Americans as well, we think of Islam as something that happened, you know, very recent. People who are Muslim in America came to the United States, you know, within the early 2000s. But this legacy of Black Muslims, of Ahmadiyya Muslims, has existed for a long period of time. And it's, you know, time that we consider Islam to be within the fabric of freedom of religion in America.
I think the other thing, Blair, is who gets to say what assimilation is? I mean, and this is also a debate, you know, that's been going on for a long time around immigration. Like the standard of what it means to assimilate must change, and one person's view of assimilation doesn't necessarily have to be the defining idea of what assimilation is.
And assimilation might not even have to be a good thing. I think that's what's so rich about America, is that we all bring our customs, we all bring our authentic, our, you know, our cultures, our rich traditions. I think America would be a very bland place if we all assimilated into this mushroom soup.
Call here from Kamal in Edina. Hey, Kamal, hi.
Hi, good morning, Kara. How are you doing today?
Doing well. Glad you called. What are you thinking about?
Well, I'm thinking about, you know, this misconception of Muslim men being oppressive to women and forcing their wives and their daughters to wear the hijab. Mm-hmm. I'm a Muslim man who's mm-hmm. married to Muslim woman and I have a Muslim daughter. And I, you know, my wife was wearing the hijab before I met her. Mm-hmm. So I have no input on that. And I definitely do not, you know, push her or encourage her to keep it. She can stop wearing it anytime she wants. And I actually discourage my young daughter not to wear it because she's too young and it's not required of her yet. So, you know, that misconception should be changed. You know, who are we to change, you know, 1.5 billion human beings and say all of their men are oppressive to women?
Come on. Now, can I just want to ask you something here, because you mentioned your daughter. Is that going to be her decision whether she wants to wear the hijab or not? Or is that something that you and your wife would really encourage her to do?
From my perspective as a father and a Muslim man in the family, it's up to her. You know, in Islam, to even become a Muslim and believe in Islam is an optional. Mm-hmm. Nobody can force you. If you don't want to be a Muslim, no parent can force you. You know, mm-hmm. belief is something, you know, too personal. Nobody can force someone else to believe what you want. So hijab is not the only option she has. You know, she has the option of not even, you know...
Kamal, thank you. You know, Nicholas, before we go to news, I wanted to say something about, because I've mentioned your podcast. If I've got the origin story right, you started the podcast with Maka because you were tired of being seen as the person who got called when something bad happened to Muslims or something negative was done by Muslims. I mean, you felt like you were seen kind of one-dimensionally. Has the podcast changed that and also changed your experience of that?
Yes, I think it was definitely one, that responsive nature, right, of when a Muslim, right, when we've deemed that a Muslim has done something bad, they want to call in another Muslim to say, hey, isn't this a bad thing? Don't you think this is a bad thing? And then the other point is that I would look in the news, I would look in pop culture, and I didn't see myself reflected. I didn't see this next generation of young Muslims that were carving out a space in America, right? It's like I kind of saw my mom's story a little bit, right, like older Black Muslims who converted, and I wanted to show, hey, no, I'm from this country. I have created a space, and I didn't see anyone grappling with the issues that I and like my friends were grappling with as being young Muslims in this country. And so that is why I started the podcast. I do think that the landscape is changing. I think just even this year, I've been really just like impressed with the coverage of Muslims in America, right? The NPR, National Geographic, and CNN just came out with 25 influential Muslims in America, and I knew people on the list, which I think a few years ago that would have never happened. So we had former podcast guests on the list, which was really exciting. And I think that landscape is starting to change, not necessarily from traditional media outlets, but from people like Blair, from people like a good friend of mine, Dr. Sawad Abdul-Khabir, who has Zapalo Square. I think these Muslims are like, you know what? Enough is enough. I'm going to create my independent platform, and you're going to love it.
Okay, we're going to talk about storytelling and why owning those platforms is really essential for understanding identity, right? And talking about identity. The series that I've been talking about by Layla Fadel is on National Public Radio. It's called Muslims in America, A New Generation. You can just Google that and find it and listen. And the podcast that I've been talking about listening to is called Identity Politics. So search that on iTunes. You're everywhere, right, Iklas?
Yes, everywhere you listen to podcasts. If you just type in Identity Politics, it'll come up under
there
shows.
There will be. And there's a good backlist there. But I'd urge you to listen to the newest conversation that went up about representation, because that was really good. To the phones to Huda in St. Cloud. Hi, Huda. Thanks so much for waiting through the newscast.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to say a couple of things. I am from Somalia, grew up in Africa, and coming to U.S., I didn't know I was Black until I came here, and I didn't know what sort of like difference between the Muslims exist before I came to U.S. So this idea of women, of Russian, and how we were told to wear the hijab is actually something that is natural. Yes, so some families, they force their daughters to wear the hijab. But I grew up at a household where my mother was a politician, my dad was a politician. Nobody forced us to wear the hijab. We chose to wear our hijab because it's a part of our identity. I also want to say that when I came to U.S., I attended two privileged black schools, Catholic schools, and I remember when I was in Notre Dame, I used to see the sisters wearing the habits, and you can't even see their ears. And I have read the Amish women, and I have seen the way they dress, and also the Mormon women. So I think this idea of whether we're assimilating or integrating into the American society is a discussion that I have been a part of for the last couple of years. And I wrote a book called From Somalia to Snow, How Central Minnesota Became Home to Somalis. And in my book, one of the chapters, chapter four, I talked about the difference between assimilation and integration. So to some extent, the Muslim people indeed assimilated, and particularly the immigrant community and the refugees who are now attending schools and graduating with higher degrees and being a teacher right now and seeing my classrooms, you know, full of girls who, you know, covered from head to toe. So there is something that we chose. It's a part of our identity. It's not something that we've been forced to. But I think our hosted community, in particular in the U.S., people don't know whether we, you know, chose to wear our dress code or we were told by our parents or our husbands and so forth. So I think education would be appropriate in order for our hosted community to understand our cultures and whether we're contributing to the economy or draining resources of the community.
Huda, I just wanted to ask you something. So you have parents for politicians. It sounds to me like you're destined for a career in politics. Is that going to happen or not?
Are you... You never know.
Maybe.
All
right. I appreciate the call. I want to grab Regina here in Rochester. Regina, you are embarking on a career in politics. Is that right?
I am, yes. I'm running for mayor.
Tell me your story.
Well, I've been an interfaith activist for almost 4 years now. I formed an interfaith nonprofit organization, and I've actually been the host of a talk show based on religion called the Faith Talk Show. It's a monthly talk show at the Rochester Public Library, and each month I have a guest from a different faith tradition pretty much provide public education on world religions, but I make it fun, I make it entertaining, and like your guests have said, I wanted to carve out that space for Muslim women to act in roles that are not commonly portrayed in the media, and it goes against misconceptions. So I wanted to point out that since my entrance as a public figure, a leader in the Muslim community in Rochester, and especially entering into the political realm, the comments, the letters that I get in my home mailbox, the emails, the comments through social media, these anti-Muslim comments are quite often intertwined with just blatant sexism.
How so?
Comments about my body, even more intimate parts of my body. You know, things like that, belittling me, calling me a whore. You know, I had a death threat when I entered into the political realm, and the death threat was just dripping with sexism, again, calling me a whore and saying I'm going to be shot. So these statements, this anti-Muslim sentiment and the way that women, Muslim women, are used, and it underlies a deep-rooted sexism that we have, this issue throughout our country that we see playing out in the Me Too movement and all that. It's being played out right here against with these misconceptions and quite often even violent attacks against Muslim women.
What do you think of that, Blair? Because, you know, as Regina is speaking, I'm saying, by the way, a lot of women in politics have to tolerate this for no good reason. But I wonder if the identity as a Muslim woman adds something to that.
You know, I never know when somebody hates me or sends hate comments to me, which is every morning. I made a hilarious rendition of Every Morning by Sugar Ray about all the DMs I receive. It's on Twitter. Check it out. But anyway, I have to kind of laugh at it because that's the way I kind of survived through it. It used to cause me panic attacks, the amount of hate I got. So now I just kind of put a comedic spin on it. But honestly, I never really know if they're coming at me from a racist angle or a sexist angle or an Islamophobic angle or a biphobic or homophobic angle. So I just kind of take it at face value, sometimes respond to kind of humanize the person they're trying to malign. Not everyone has to do that. By no means saying that's a safe or even reasonable option for most folks. But I think that people hate and vehemently, like, they're just like viscerally opposed to difference and to contrast and to people going against the norm.
Right.
And we can see that with leaders across the centuries. And, you know, my parents, who always react really interestingly to my death threats, my mom was like, well, that means you're making a difference. And I was like, Mom, I'm not safe. But she viewed it as, you know, I'm joining the ranks of people throughout our history who have made disruptions in the world, positive change in the world, and who have, you know, suffered the backlash of society. So my mom's proud. I'm a little rattled, but, you know, got to roll with the punches.
Iklas, I think Blair is talking about the bravery to defy the norm and how frightening that feels to people.
Yes.
And then that turns into hate.
I think so.
I mean,
the premise of starting the podcast, too, is, you know, the tagline is that we feature new perspectives on race, gender, and Muslims in America. And what we really wanted to focus on, which is why it's not so much Islam 101, but it's, right, what lies underneath, right? It happens within the Muslim community, but also exists in every single space you go into. Just the racism and issues with gender, sexism, classism, right? All of these things exist, which manifest when you put them and a space. So yeah, if you put them within Islam, if you put it within Christianity, you're going to see these things happen. So we're really trying to get at the heart of the issue. Like, why do you hate me? Why don't you want women to work, right? And we're not just talking about Muslims, but like, this just exists within America, like, right? Not wanting women to work, not wanting women to receive equal pay, paying Black women specifically lower, right? So all of these things are existing because we haven't worked out our issues. And that's why you hate me. That's why you can't get past that point.
Iklas, I think you've just demonstrated why having your own platform, right, to create your own identity is really important. And I was reading something that Jihad Turk has been talking about, the head of this Islamic grad school in California. And I wonder if you and Blair agree with this. He says the sign of us having arrived in America is not just that we are consumers of culture, but that we're producers of culture, that we contribute to the art and to the aesthetic of what it means to be an American. That sounded pretty powerful to me. How does it sound to you?
I think for me, it's complex, right? It reminds me of what a lot of folks are saying. I can't remember who specifically said the quote, but if America loved
Black culture as much as they love Black people, we would be all right. And I think that's the same with Muslim culture, like the different elements. And I think that it really depends on what you define as arriving in America, right? Like, does that mean that America is consuming from you in a exploitive way? Does that mean that America values you? And what does that value look like? Is it tangible? Does it mean that you're well-resourced? But I think it does show our impact, and I think that's something to be proud of.
Blair?
Oh, sorry, that was...
sorry, Blair.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think something that often kind of bothers me about saying, you know, we arrive when we're producers of culture, I immediately like, well, Black Muslims have been producing culture since we've been here. And so it's, I mean, almost exclusionary, right, to say that we haven't been producing culture. We have Black Muslim filmmakers, music artists, right? And, you know, if you want to point to someone who is larger than life, right, like Muhammad Ali. And so it's, we've always been pushing the culture envelope, but it hasn't been received as being like, oh, these are Black Muslims, right? You might just say, oh, this is a Black person, but not acknowledging that other identity factor that, you know, they're Black Muslims who have been producing culture. And in terms of arrival, I agree with everything Blair said, right? Like, how are you consuming that? Where it is that really, are you really being reflective in that consumption, right? Or are you just appropriating? And I think that's a challenge that we have with everything when we're taking in culture.
Iklas, how many episodes are there going to be in season 4 of Identity Politics? More
yeah,
to come.
So there are more to come, definitely more to come. We're a 2-person team right now, and so we're trying to push them out as fast as we can, but they come out every other week, and our latest episode just dropped yesterday. We're talking about Ramadan, and so that's coming up within a week or so. And so just thinking about how do you prepare for Ramadan, and it's not just an episode for Muslims, right? There's things to gain if you aren't Muslim, if you don't observe Ramadan, but just thinking about how do you get comfortable sitting in silence. Right. And we live in this country where everything, you're on the go all day, every day. And so how do you take those moments to pause, to breathe, to reflect? Because doing this work is exhausting, as I'm sure you know, Carrie and Blair. Like, you don't take those moments for yourself. And so we're reflecting on that in the latest episode.
Really good to have you on the show, Iklas. Thank you.
Thank you.
Blair, thank you. Really good to have
you on
the show.
Thank you for having
me. Thanks a lot. We're continuing our conversation about the American Muslim experience with a piece of reporting from Leila Fadel. As you heard from our guests and our callers, there is no monolithic Muslim experience. It's especially true in America, where Muslims represent dozens of backgrounds and cultures and races. For some context, there's a little over 3 million Muslims in America. That number is significant, but it's only 1% of the total population. And in that minority of Americans, one sliver feels particularly vulnerable. It's LGBTQ Muslims. Leila Fadel found one place of worship in Chicago that's trying to change that.
The only sign for Masjid Arabia's prayer space on Friday is a sandwich board at a side entrance of the Second Unitarian Church on the north side of Chicago.
Do you move the banner from the other door?
Oh, no.
I'll grab it.
Inside, the executive director, Madia Lin, gets ready for the Community Friday prayer. She pulls out a couple boxes of donated books in the church library. That's also the mosque office.
These are our Qurans. We have Chinese, English, Tamil.
Lin's a 30-year-old transgender woman. She converted to Islam and is one of the founders of Masjid al-Rabia. The mosque's namesake is a female Sufi, Muslim, mystic, and saint. It opened its doors a year and a half ago, and it's a place where all Islamic sects, all sexualities, all gender identities, all are welcomed.
You can live true to Islam while remaining inclusive and affirming, and be a part of a justice-facing community that is feminist, that is affirming, that is uncompromising in its inclusivity.
She takes me to the room they transform into a prayer space every week. The congregation is anywhere from just 2 people to 20.
Kind of open space, and we set up kind of right in the middle.
A volunteer sets up a folding table for the books, Quran surrounded by texts, mostly by Muslim feminists. They roll out a layer of prayer rugs, and then Lin asks me to turn off my recorder. Friday prayer, she says, is a safe space. Congregants are a mix of LGBTQ Muslims, straight Muslims, converts, and people born into the faith. One mother, a straight woman, tells me she chose the space for herself and for her children because she wants them to be raised in an inclusive religious community. Some of the queer Muslims here, like those of other faiths, worry about being open about their sexuality or gender identity.
I am a little, like, concerned because a lot of the people that know me, some of them don't necessarily agree with the affirmation of an LGBT Muslim lifestyle, let alone a mosque.
That's one of the congregants I reach later by Skype. She asks me to use only her first initial, E, because she's worried about being ostracized by her family and the community she grew up in. She's bisexual, Muslim, in her 20s, and she thought her mom, a feminist who always taught her that faith is about love and mercy, would be fine with her sexuality. But before she could come out, they were watching a talk show together where LGBTQ people recounted attacks. Her mother said, "That's not right." He asked her what she meant.
Look, they will come to terms with their sins, and then they too will ascend to heaven. But that doesn't mean that, oh, we should take advantage of a loving God and then just do whatever we want.
So he thought she had to choose between her religion and her sexuality. Then she met Madialyn and other Muslims like her in Chicago who would eventually create Masjid al-Rabia. She read an interpretation of the Quran that challenged traditional Islamic understandings of sex between the same gender as sin.
After realizing that there are many interpretations to the faith, realizing that I'm like, I cannot and I will not choose between my two identities.
That's why, she says, places like Masjid al-Rabia and the group of pioneers who founded it are so important. He says before this community,
I literally knew nobody else that, you know, identified as such. Plenty of Christians, even some Jewish individuals, but not Muslim.
Other religious communities are having these same internal struggles about inclusion and homophobia. But she worries that by drawing attention to these issues within Muslim communities in America, she'll just give more ammunition to those who are intent on demonizing her religion. Places like Masjid al-Rabia are rare, but there are informal prayer circles in other American cities, a mosque with a similar mission in Toronto, Canada that's been open since 2009, and an annual LGBTQ Muslim retreat put together by the Muslim Alliance for Sexual and Gender Diversity. Blair Imani is an author and social justice activist who's also a bisexual Muslim woman. She says Masjid al-Rabia is a step forward.
I've just seen the power overwhelmingly of people like coming to the space, calling out the space and just feeling a sense of ownership over a space that really centers and affirms them.
Now, she says the opening of this mosque doesn't mean there are waves of acceptance, but it does show that when LGBTQ people of faith find the resources, they'll create those accepting spaces for themselves and for others.
It's a shift from the idea that we can't be Muslim because we're LGBT. You know, I'm bisexual and I'm Muslim at the same time, and that still blows people's minds. And it really shouldn't, because I don't find a controversy within myself. It's mostly from the external.
Hello.
I hear from Masjid al-Rabia.
Right, coming now.
Back at the mosque, executive director Madialyn buzzes congregants in. She says things are changing slowly. They don't hide their location anymore. They did it first for fear of being targeted. The numbers back that up. A survey by Pew Research Center asked people whether, quote, homosexuality should be accepted by society. In the case of Muslim millennials in America, 60% said yes versus 44% of the older generation.
Every Muslim should have a right to pray without fear of violence or excommunication. And I believe that that space needs to exist right here. And that's what Masjid al-Rabia is.
But what Lynn ultimately hopes for is to make every mosque a mosque for all Muslims.
Leila Fadel there, and the series is called Muslims in America, A New Generation. Listen.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.